First, I'll introduce myself. My name's Sandra Henville and I coordinate the care group at the Buddhist Society. And I also run midweek community meditation classes. So tonight I wanted to talk a bit about freedom through forgiveness. But before I start, I'd like to let you know that the care line is now open. So there's a little house around the back here, and it's staffed by volunteers. And there are people who are ready and willing to take calls. So if you feel as though it is something you'd like to talk about, particularly given the topic of tonight's Dharma talk, if you feel you'd like to reach out and be heard, be listened to without fear of judgment, then pick up the phone and I'll read the number out to you. It is 08-6270-4671. The country code being +61. And you can also call via WhatsApp. So you can use your phone, use the WhatsApp, and dial in +61 493 056 327, and that makes it a much cheaper phone call. The number is now on the screen, so it should be down the bottom. And the care line is open till 9 p.m. So 6:30 to 9 p.m. every Wednesday. So now I will quit being a millennial and put the device away, and we'll enjoy a nice bit of a talk, a bit of a discussion, and a meditation. So I always like to work to a fairly simple formula. We come together, we greet each other as friends, as Kalyana Mitta. We have a discussion, we meditate, and then we drink tea. So tonight I've bought the mint, but I forgot the teapot. So let's manifest the teapot. So freedom through forgiveness. Now, this is a pretty tricky topic, actually. It really is quite loaded. So I did quite a lot of reading, listened to quite a few Dharma talks, and try to have a look at this. So take a few moments to consider, what do you really mean when you say to someone, "I forgive you"? It's kind of interesting. When we're kids, you know, our mum would say to us, "Oh, you know, say sorry to Charlie for, I don't know, stepping on his tail or stealing his toy." And, you know, we dutifully say, "I'm sorry." But then as we become adults, we get more of a sense of our own world and our own being. What does it really mean when you say to someone, "I forgive you"? Now, it's inevitable being humans. We've all betrayed and hurt others, just as we've knowingly or unknowingly been harmed by them too. It is inevitable in this human realm. None of our parents were arahants. I don't think there's any arahants in the room. Sometimes our betrayals are small and sometimes they're terrible. So spiritual leaders, from the Buddha to modern leaders, like Mahatma Gandhi and Martin Luther King Jr., have all pondered over the power of forgiveness. The weak can never forgive. Forgiveness is the attribute of the strong, Mahatma Gandhi once said. Martin Luther King, an avid follower of Gandhi, took this principle to the next level and explained, "We must develop and maintain this capacity to forgive. He or she who is devoid of the power to forgive is devoid of the power to love. There is some good in the worst of us and some evil in the best of us. When we discover this, We are less prone to hate our enemies. And in contemporary Buddhist settings, forgiveness is interpreted in several ways. And I always have a bit of a chuckle when I see this quote. I think it's attributed to Jack Kornfield, but it just gets quoted everywhere, it seems. Forgiveness means giving up on a hope for a better past. So ever think about that. Giving up on the hope for a better past. It's in the past. It's arisen and it's past. Forgiveness is a way to move on. So when we look at the way forgiveness is interpreted in contemporary Buddhist settings, one is a way of letting go of our expectations and disappointments, in other words, so letting go of our attachment to a different past. Another interpretation is as an extension of loving kindness. And in the Tibetan tradition, it is sometimes presented as an extension of patience and compassion. So they're all quite lovely definitions. But I think there's a bit of a trap. And when I was reading through various materials, there's one author, Ken MacLeod, he wrote a book called Wake Up to Your Life, Discovering the Buddha's Path of Attention. And he kind of explains this. Because we need to consider the cultural baggage we carry in these modern times and be careful not to ground the language of forgiveness in debt. So in the days of yore, long time ago, and in some cultures not so yore, if I impugned your honour, I incurred an obligation to you, a debt that had to be paid somehow. From there, the notion developed that when I do any kind of wrong to you or anyone else, I've incurred a debt to you, to society, to God. But I've incurred a debt. So when we view interactions with others in terms of debt, we are wittingly or unwittingly reducing our relationships with others to transactions. So human feeling, human understanding, human empathy all go out the door. And it becomes a case of I owe you or you owe me. And that's now the defining expression of our relationship. I forgive you, just like I forgo a debt. So the bank writes off bad debts. I've released you of your obligations. I've released myself of my obligations. And in today's world, the person owed has a certain moral power supported by custom, the law, or the state. And there's quite a famous book written by David Graeber. He's an American anthropologist. And it's called The First 5,000 Years, Debt, The First 5,000 Years. And what he says is, there's no better way to justify relations founded on violence, to make such relations seem moral, than by reframing them in the language of debt. Above all, because it immediately makes it seem that it's a victim who is doing something wrong. Now, in Buddhist psychology, forgiveness is not presented as a moral commandment, thou shalt forgive. It's understood as a way to end suffering, to bring dignity and harmony to life. Forgiveness is fundamentally for our own sake. It's a way to let go of the pain that we carry. It's for our own mental health. And people are really quite confused about forgiveness, and I came across this really interesting PhD study by a young lady, Masami Matsuyuki, in Kentucky. And she noticed some really interesting discrepancies in the understanding of forgiveness. So some studies that she researched suggested that people only partially agreed upon the conceptual definitions of forgiveness. And there was really notable individual differences in how people understand and experience forgiveness. And I guess that's not really that surprising. But she quoted this piece of research by some French researchers. Now, I'm sure the way you pronounce this is not Mullet, so we'll say Millet. So Millet, in 2004, he asked 1,029 people in France, including students, about who half identified as believing in a god, to indicate the extent of their agreement or disagreement to 93 sentences, referring to conceptions of forgiveness. So these are forgiveness experts who've written these 93 questions. And what was fascinating in this was that only 23%, so less than a quarter of the participants, believe that forgiveness would transform their negative emotions towards the offender. So not many people believed that forgiveness could transform their negative emotions towards an offender into positive emotions. And then only less than half, 46% of the participants believe that the forgiven could be an unknown offender or an abstract institution like the church. So it's quite, I found that quite interesting. And there was another bit of research by some American researchers, and they looked at 196 undergrad students and 83 adults in Tennessee and asked them what forgiveness meant to them. And what they found was the adults tended to define forgiveness in very emotional terms. They'd say it's letting go of negative emotions towards the offender, while the students tended to define it in behavioural terms. So the students are in the 20s, the adults are in the 40s or so. And the students defined forgiveness in behaviour terms, acceptance of what had happened, dealing with the event, getting over it. And quite a small number, so only around 25% of the students and 16% of the adults define forgiveness as reconciliation. So bringing it back to the Buddhist teachings, so it's actually quite fascinating when you take the words back to their roots. So in Pali, the word for forgiveness is karma. So not karma, karma, which means the earth, also means the earth. And it said a mind like the earth is non-reactive and unperturbed. So when you forgive me for harming you, you decide not to retaliate, not to seek revenge. You don't have to like me. You simply unburden yourself of the weight of resentment and cut the cycle of retribution that would keep us in this samsaric wrestling match. And that's a gift you can give us both, totally on your own, without me even having to know or understand what you've done. So that's quite important to realise, because I think a lot of people think that to forgive someone, you've got to meet them face to face. You don't actually have to do that. So the risk of not forgiving and being stuck in that state of samsara, that discord, it's illustrated by the story of two ex-prisoners of war who meet after many years. And the first one asks the other, "Have you forgiven your captors yet?" And the second man says, "No, never." "Well then," the first man replies, "they still have you in prison." And there's another story going back 2,500 years ago to the time of the Buddha. And the Buddha was sitting under a tree, as the Buddha did talking to his followers, and a man came and he spat on his face. And the Buddha wiped it off and asked the man, "What next?" And the monks, the Buddha's disciples, became very angry at this strange man's behavior. But the Buddha calmed them down and he said, "You keep silent. He has not offended me, but you are offending me. He is new. He is a stranger. He must have heard from people something about me, that this man is an atheist, a dangerous man who is throwing people off their track, a revolutionary, a corrupter. And he may have formed some idea, a notion of me. He has not spit on me, he has spit on his notion. He has spit on his idea of me because he doesn't know me at all. So how can he spit on me?" The Buddha then added, "If you think on it deeply, he's spit on his own mind. I'm not part of it." Now, forgiveness is quite different to reconciliation. In the Pali, it's Patisaranaya Kama. And it means a return to amicability, and it requires a little more than forgiveness. So it requires the re-establishing of trust. So if I deny responsibility for my actions or maintain that I did no wrong, there's no way we can be reconciled. Similarly, if I insist that your feelings don't matter or that you have no right to hold me to your standards of right or wrong, you won't trust me not to hurt you again. To regain your trust, I have to show my respect for you and for our mutual standards of what is and what isn't acceptable behaviour, to admit that I hurt you and I was wrong to do so, and to promise to exercise restraint in the future. At the same time, you have to inspire my trust, too, in a respectful way. You conduct a process of reconciliation. Only then can our friendship regain a solid footing. So we meet and we go forth together, quite different to that notion of forgiveness. So that sounds like pretty daunting stuff, given some of the things that, you know, we feel we need to forgive in life, some of the experiences we may have had. And the Buddha admitted that not all disputes can be reconciled. There are times when one or both parties are unwilling to exercise the honesty and restraint that true reconciliation requires. Even then, though, forgiveness is still an option. This is why the distinction between reconciliation and forgiveness is so important. It encourages us not to settle for mere forgiveness when the genuine healing of right reconciliation is possible. And it allows us to be generous with our forgiveness even when it's not. So to encourage a wrongdoer to see reconciliation as a winning rather than a losing proposition, the Buddha praised the honest acceptance of blame as an honourable rather than a shameful act, not just as a means, but the means of progress in spiritual practice. He told his son Rahula, "The ability to recognize one's mistakes and admit them to others is the essential factor in achieving purity in thought, word, and deed." And you can read that in the Mahima Nikaya. And I won't go through the whole thing, but essentially, he sits his son down and he says to him, "Rahula, all those Brahmins and contemplatives in the course of the past who purified their bodily actions, their verbal actions, and their mental actions, did it through repeated reflection on their bodily actions, their verbal actions, and mental actions." So they had a level of self-compassion, a level of reflection. And he goes on with the talking about the Brahmins and contemplatives in the course of the past, the course of the future, the course of the present. So what he's saying is to his son is that you should train yourself. I will purify my bodily actions through repeated reflection. I will purify my verbal actions through repeated reflection. I will purify my mental actions through repeated reflection. That's how you should train yourself. So it's not that transactional, I absolve you of debt, I write off your debt. It's more an act of compassion and reflection. It's removing the self from the picture. Or as the Buddha said in the Dhammapada, people who recognize their own mistakes and change their ways illumine the world like the moon freed from the clouds. That's quite beautiful. And it's not just Buddhism that says these things. And so what's really interesting is that when you go back to some of the original Christian orientated teachings, they also have a focus on forgiveness as being an act of self-compassion. It's not praying to the omnipresent God to take away our sins and forgive us. And you can see it in the Gospel of Thomas. If you bring forth that which is within you, what is within you will serve you. You might be quite surprised by those statements. And something that you may or may not heard of, a Course in Miracles, it's a kind of like a transmission. But a lady, Helen Schuckman, recorded. And there's a lesson in there: fear binds the world, forgiveness sets it free. And this is how it reads: the ego makes illusions. Truth undoes its evil dreams by shining them away. Truth never makes attack, it merely is. And by its presence is the mind recalled from fantasies, awakening to the real. Forgiveness bids this presence enter in and take its rightful place within the mind. Without forgiveness is the mind in chains, believing its own futility. Yet with forgiveness does the light shine through the dream of darkness, offering it hope and giving it the means to realize that freedom is its inheritance. So forgiveness releases us from the power of fear and allows us to see kindly with a wise heart. So first we need to understand forgiveness, then we need to learn how it is practiced, and then how we may forgive ourselves and others. And the Buddha said, if it were not possible to free the heart from entanglement and greed and hate and fear and delusion, I would not teach you or ask you to do so. The power of forgiveness releases us from the power of fear. So, just before we get into the meditation, one of the monastic I really love listening to is a nun, a bhikkhuni by the name of Aya Medanandi. And Aya Medanandi is the founder and guiding teacher of Sati Saranaya Hermitage. It's a forest monastery for women in the Theravadan tradition. And she's the daughter of an Eastern European refugee who emigrated to Montreal after World War II. And I just love the way she gives her Dharma talks, that she doesn't hold back. She's so kind, but she's pretty fierce. So she embodies that. I think it's Rick Hansen who says, be friendly, be peaceable, but be fearless. I love that about her. And she gives the following advice in a talk. You can find it on Dharma Seed. It's called We Are Here to Forgive. And her advice is to treat situation like an incursion on the consciousness. Adopt the devotion to healing. Make the heart resilient, not just on the outside, but on the inside through our inner ways of healing. So the Buddha understood how we can change our karma and bring our minds back into balance in the company and solidarity of good spiritual friends. And that's why it's so important to have this Kalyana Mitta, to have people come together like we are now to meditate. It stops us from becoming overly identified with being a victim of suffering. So people may well have harmed you in the past, but they're not harming you right now in this moment. And that's a very important point. No one is harming you right now in this moment, in this present moment. Our thoughts are what harms us and make us believe that the past is happening right now. So rather than allowing those tapes to replay, learn what you don't want to repeat. And she proposes four ways of doing this. And we'll just explore this a little bit in our meditation. But firstly, and this sounds really hard, but welcome the thoughts in. It reminds me of another story from the suttas where the Buddha is giving a talk, talking to the Sangha, and there's a character called Mara. Mara is a bit of a devil. He likes to just be really disruptive. So the Buddha's settling down to give a talk, and in comes Mara, who's been totally disruptive, really hamming it up. And the monks are very worried about this, like, oh my God, you know, here is Mara, come to disrupt the peace again. What are we going to do? And the Buddha says, invite him in for tea. Come in for tea, Mara, come sit next to me. Like, so don't be fearful. Invite him in for tea. So the first step is welcome the thoughts in. So welcome Mara in, but remember, this is your space of kindness and compassion. If you don't want to open the door, don't open the door. But when you're ready, invite the thoughts in. The second is to recognize, restrain, release, but only if it's comfortable and skillful to do so. So if the thoughts are not skillful, then recognize them as such. Is it serving me? No. Let it go. Memories are just that. You might be bringing a lot of people with you. So just let them go. Easier said than done, I know. The third part, set boundaries. Create a mental environment that is safe for you. If you're not ready to deal with those thoughts, then don't deal with those thoughts now. Be kind and compassionate to yourself. This is what I'll think about. This is what I'll leave behind for now. Start with the small stuff, not the biggest things. And seek out trusted friends. Seek out trusted people and friends that support the best in us. Remembering that the worst in us is what we create, and we have the power to abandon that. And it's kind of like the way Aya Medinandi explains it. Sounds like our Verge efforts today. It's about pulling out the weeds in the garden to let the flowers bloom. And that can be quite tricky, right? Because the weeds are very intertwined with the flowers. But, you know, gradually we pull the weeds out when we're ready. I think what we'll do is we'll now move into the meditation. So what the meditation allows us to do is kind of scope out the terrain and see and know that there's a way through these things. And the Buddha recommended two types of meditation to address anger and embrace forgiveness. The first was Vipassana, or insight meditation. And that involves recognizing the feelings that arise, but processing them without attachment, so seeing things as they are, and managing the feelings dispassionately allows room for forgiveness. The other type is metta meditation, or loving kindness meditation, where you use the breath to focus on feelings of loving kindness for oneself, and then in stages you gradually move out, gradually incorporating people around you till eventually you feel ready to incorporate the people who you feel the most hostility towards. And then finally, the entire universe. Knowing that remaining attached to anger causes suffering, embracing forgiveness reflects wisdom and compassion. So just pondering that. So in all of that, I guess what I'm trying to impart is that there's a real, in order to forgive, we need to have compassion to ourselves. And maybe we need to, spend a lot of time on that, spend a bit of time on that, being kind to ourselves, so that we can, have that strength of character and mind to look outwards. So I'd invite you, we've got about just under 30 minutes remaining. I invite you to make yourselves comfortable, and we'll enjoy a 30-minute meditation. Before I came, I listened to a lot of different meditations, and there was quite a few meditations where you sort of applied a metta type approach where you acknowledged that, you might have betrayed and hurt others, and you forgive yourself for that, and then you move to forgive others, and so on and so forth. But I think what we'll do tonight is focus on building that self-compassion first. So what I invite you to do is just gently close down the eyes if it's comfortable to do so. Or pick a spot in front of you. And it always helps just to shift the gaze just down beyond the nose. This helps calm the movements of the mind. There's quite a bit to take in with that talk. So, it's allowing yourself to come into the body. Awareness of the body being the first factor of mindfulness. So becoming aware of your body sitting on the cushion or chair. Just becoming aware of any sensations in the body. And it's not so much to overly focused on the body, but more just using the body as a bit of an anchor point. It's always with us. A vehicle for our awareness. Become aware of sounds. So on this Wednesday night, we can hear sounds of cars outside. Sounds in the room. I just invite you to allow those sounds to drift into your field of awareness. You watch them arise, noting hearing, listening, then watch the way they change and fall away. So it's not like we follow the sounds, we just simply acknowledge them, arising and passing. Becoming aware of the sensations in the body. Becoming aware of the movement of the breath. The feeling the in-breath and the out-breath. You might even put one hand on your heart and the other on your tummy. It's feeling the way the air gets drawn in through the nostrils. Filling up the chest and then the tummy. And falling away. Tummy falling down. Chest sinking, breath leaving the nostrils. Just enjoying a few rounds of breath. Noticing its very calming effect. And starting to listen deeply, starting to listen to the sound of the breath, noticing the sound of the in-breath and the out-breath. Nice, even, steady rhythm. Allowing the body to relax, connecting with the earth, the strong, resilient earth, always ready to receive and hold us. Second factor of awareness, becoming aware of feelings, of emotions, becoming aware of any thoughts, any movements of mind, and again, just Just like the sounds and sensations, just watching the way those feelings, those emotions and thoughts arise. They exist, and then they pass. And if it feels right to do so, you welcome them in. Come in and have tea. Come sit quietly with me. And whatever emotions or feelings are there, greeting them with acceptance, just the way they are. Simply movements of mind. Remembering, if we're not ready to receive the thoughts, just let them go. And bring your awareness into the heart space. Cheetah, a heart mind. It's feeling into the heart space. There's the physical heart, then there's the spiritual heart. You feel the rise and fall of the breath. Starting to feel the embodiment of the breath. The body of the breath in terms of the whole cycle of the breath. But also the embodiment of the breath, the movements in the chest, the slight rise and fall of the shoulders, the opening of the heart. And starting to notice the different flavor of awareness in the heart space. The slight softness, like a soft seed, waiting to sprout forth new growth. Becoming aware of the spaciousness of the heart. A third factor of mindfulness, spaciousness. Spaciousness in the heart, spaciousness in the mind. a heart that's open to forgiveness. To reconciliation. Bring your awareness down into the tummy, dropping the awareness down, feeling into the tummy. So again, feeling the bodily movements of the belly, of the pelvis, the lower back, the hips. It's feeling very, very subtle movements with each and every in-breath and out-breath. Becoming aware of any feelings or sensations in the belly. It might be quite a visceral feeling, home of our gut reactions. And again, just letting those feelings arise. Noticing them as sensations and accepting them just the way they are. Inviting them in for tea. Come sit with me. Come be still. Let us sit together. Spirit of forgiveness, of reconciliation. And taking the time to just observe the arising and passing of sensations. Either physical or metaphysical. And feeling the flavor of awareness. Feeling a sense of spaciousness. Sense of warmth. Warm like the earth we sit on. Remembering those words, a mind like the earth, it's non-reactive, unperturbed. Letting the earth settle. Sitting on a solid footing. Reconciling, meeting the earth, grounded. Safe in this present moment. Knowing you're sitting. knowing you're breathing. Feeling the spaciousness within, the spaciousness around, all breathing together, all sitting together. An open-hearted Kalyanamitta circle of friends. Gently watching the breath. Watching the in-breath. Receiving the in-breath. Letting go on the out-breath. And the Buddha said, to know that you're sitting, to know that you're breathing, is to see the whole of the Dharma. Seeing things just as they are. When you're ready, maybe turning your gaze inwards, softening the eyes, bringing a smile to your face, looking inwards, looking into the beauty, the spaciousness of your own mind. With a kind heart, compassionate heart, it's like the in-breath is the future, the out-breath's the past, and in between these two is the present. Coming into presence, developing that wisdom to see things as they are. Perfect in this present moment. at peace. Forgiveness, reconciliation, love. I'd like to finish with a quote from Nisargadatta. Which is not a Buddhist quote, but I think it's very beautiful. Love tells me I am everything. Wisdom tells me I am nothing. Between these two, my life flows. At a short moment, I'll ring the bell to bring the meditation to a close. I'd like you to just come back to that still place within, feeling into the heart space, the citta, the heart mind. And when you're ready, saying a gentle thank you to yourself. Self-compassionate thank you to yourself for taking this time to care and to be kind, to connect with your heart. And then honoring those around us with respect and with reverence. Just bringing those hands back to the heart. Just gently opening the eyes, turning to the people next to you and saying thank you to them too. So thank you, everybody. How beautiful Kalyana Mitta for meditating together this evening. Now, important announcements on finishing. So first and foremost, before we pay respects to the Buddha Dharma Sangha, the care line number should still be at the bottom of the screen. The lines are open till 9 o'clock. So if you feel that you need to talk to someone, particularly if you've been triggered in any way, pick up the phone. There are people ready to listen. And the second most important thing, and I can see Ron making a move, and that is because he is ambling his way to the kitchen where there is tea and biscuits and plenty of opportunity for fellowship. So please come and join us. But before we all move off, we'll just pay respects to the Buddha Dharma Sangha. So thank you, online friends. We'll see you next Wednesday. And we will go in search of a teapot. See you later.